This is Book Public from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. On this episode of Book Public, I talk to Willie Vlauten about his latest novel, The Horse. Al Ward is the protagonist in Willie Vlauten's seventh novel, The Horse. He's a 65-year-old musician living on an isolated mining claim that belonged to his uncle in the high desert of central Nevada. He's 50 miles away from the nearest town, doesn't have a working vehicle, and has meager provisions consisting of Campbell's soup and instant coffee. He spends his time recalling his past, his childhood, his long and labyrinthine stint as a touring musician in the Nevada casino circuit, and the women in his life, including his ex-wife, Maxine. He also recalls his music. He was a talented songwriter and a prolific one. His reveries are infused with the people he's known, the places he's been, the songs he's written. Al has returned to this little mining claim because he's lost. The resolve to be sober is on the wane. He's drinking again. He has insomnia, anxiety, and perhaps a depression that depletes him. The downward spiral has found him in his isolation until one day a horse arrives on his doorstep. The horse is blind, wounded, helpless. Is the horse real? Does it represent something for Al? As Al considers what he can do to help the horse, he begins to recall his lifetime of memories, his childhood, his music career, his friendships, his failures. As he moves in and out of these memories, he sees the horse is still there, right outside the door. What will he do to save the horse and himself? Author Willie Vlauten knows a thing or two about horses and writing novels, and also about writing songs. He's the founding member of the band Richmond Fontaine and the DeLines. Readers of The Horse will delight in encountering some 230 song titles interspersed throughout the book. There are also song lyrics here and there, and the song titles add something of a guide for the arc of this story of Al's. Fans of Willie Vlauten will recognize some of the songs from the latest album by the DeLines, Mr. Luck and Miss Doom. I spoke to Willie Vlauten about his latest novel, The Horse. But first, let's listen to a little bit of The Haunting Thoughts.
Every morning when I wake up feeling bleak, and I'm nervous that the feeling might never leave, like I'm circling a drain, I know I ain't. Every time I see something on the street, like some drugged out woman who ain't even 20, or some guy passed out OD, I know it ain't me, and I just keep walking.
Well, thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, it's my pleasure. My pleasure. I wore my Willie Nelson sweatshirt. He's been my private saint my whole life. He was the long-haired hippie that got it, that my mom liked. My mom was pretty conservative and not a big fan of the arts, but she loved Willie. And so I was always a big Willie fan from when I was a little kid, and continue to be.
Wow, it's so funny that you're saying that. One, because I've been talking to a friend of mine about the Redheaded Stranger album.
Yeah, sure.
And last night on my PBS channel, there was a tribute. It was a 2016 show honoring Kris Kristofferson. And of course, Willie was on the stage. And then right after that show was a concert of the Highwaymen, that famous recorded concert of the Highwaymen. So it's so funny that you're bringing up Willie Nelson.
Oh, that's crazy. You know, I have a truckload of regrets, but one of them was I was too lazy to go see the Highwaymen. I grew up in Reno and they were playing through Reno and I was like, oh, I'll see them next time. And I don't know what I was thinking, but I was a kid. So I'll cut myself some slack because I was a dumb kid. But man, oh man.
Oh man. Well, at least we have these PBS shows, I guess.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Well, Kris Kristofferson, I've always sort of been into, because my mom is someone who really loves Kris Kristofferson. You know, Texas boy and all that. But yeah, some of the songs they were playing on that concert, I did not really know all of the songs. I knew sort of like the big hits, I guess. He was talented.
Oh, yeah. And he didn't wear a shirt for most of the 70s. That's probably why your mom loved him, too. I mean, he was a pretty cool guy from all accounts. I mean, I think he was a pretty stand up, pretty honorable guy too, besides being a good actor, and like Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, he was great in that one, and a brilliant songwriter. Yeah, I think he was a pretty cool guy. So your mom had good taste.
I think you're right, because the album cover that I'm thinking about, I don't think he was wearing a shirt. Jesus Was a Capricorn.
Yeah, man. I don't think he wore many shirts, or he forgot to button them. There's a famous him and, Rita Coolidge.
Rita Coolidge.
Who he was married. There's them, like, Help Me Make It Through the Night, or like, I think it's on Saturday Night Live, where they're practically making out while they're singing. It's kind of uncomfortable and really funny and awesome all at the same time.
I'm going to have to look for that. That is funny. I have to tell you, I've been carrying this book around. I feel, Willie, like everybody must have an Al Ward somewhere in their life. I'm wondering if this is true or not, but I feel like I have an Al in my past, in my life, and I've really been thinking a lot about this idea of everybody having an Al Ward somewhere.
You mean like an Al Ward in the fact that he's kind of beat up, but in what regard are you saying that?
You know, the person I'm thinking about is a guy who is pretty reclusive, is really smart. The end, you know, but there's much more to Al. But that's it's sort of like this, and this person is not addicted to anything except, I think, his own sorrows. I think he is just someone who, but see, now I'm going to take it back because Al, I don't think of Al that way. I don't necessarily think of Al as someone who wants to be alone all the time.
I think he kind of ran out of ideas of how to keep living the way he was living.
Yeah.
And I think he knew, you know, like most people, when things get rough, a lot of people anyway, tend to isolate. Or you dream about, oh, it would be nice if I lived away from people. I lived in more desolate or in a romantic sense, you know, I want to live on a ranch or whatever, but isolation is the killer. It's, you know, it's like an agoraphobic who says, oh, I'll just hide in my house. It takes from you more than it gives. So the more you hide from the world, the more it beats you up, the world. And in Al's case, I think what he was left with when he ran away was himself and his mind and his past. And that's a hard thing to be around. And I think we all kind of can spiral if we spend too much time by ourselves, too isolated. I mean, you know, people go crazy. And I think you see that a little bit in Al. Like he starts falling apart towards the end from that isolation. The darker side of isolation appears when you're truly alone. But yes, man, when your home life's stable, or you know you're loved in a stable way, and then you're by yourself, oh, Jesus, that's heaven. That's pure heaven. My dream would always be like if my wife was happy with me going to like some podunk town in the West somewhere and just living in a motel and writing and just walking around all day and then just writing, I'd be the happiest. That would be, for me, would be heaven, with no guilt and no fear that this is it. And I don't have anybody, and I'm living in a small town. But man, when you have the safety of a family, man, that the isolation's the best.
Well, let me ask you to set the table for us about The Horse. What's the summary? What's the elevator pitch when people ask you, what's it about? What do you say?
I mean, I think it's about the life of a journeyman musician. It's the life of a guy who has lived inside art to get by at his own detriment at times. And it's not about success or failure at the art. It's about a guy that's used art as a way to get through life. So I think Al is a guy that just kind of got the wind knocked out of him early on, and he was trying to recover his whole life, and he kind of hid inside and inside art, inside music to get by. So that would be my bad elevator pitch. You know, I wouldn't be much of a used car salesman. And I've tried to sell books that way, but yeah, that's what I would think of. It's a guy that lived inside art.
He did that. And I don't want to psychoanalyze him and take it all the way back, you know, in some...
No, we can't.
we can't. That's so true. Like in this Freudian way, like back to his childhood and where's his dad and what's going on with this kind of, I don't know, abandonment or what is happening. What we have is Al in this old mining claim living there in this shack. And he's there. This is a place where he goes to sober up. And suddenly this horse appears. And is there a horse? Isn't there a horse? Well, there's a horse of a type for sure. And I read an interview where you said, all my books started as songs, or words to that effect. And it made me wonder then, where do the songs start? And then where is the idea of the horse? What was the inspiration for the horse?
I've never known where songs come from or where melody comes from. I guess, you know, I started writing songs as a kid. I think I was 11 years old when I first started writing tunes. And I think in the early days, I was just, you know, like aimlessly kind of drifting about song-wise. But I always wrote story songs. And I think where my songs come from, really, it's just the idea of a story. I'll think of a story first, and then I'll think, what would be a good soundtrack to that story? And that's kind of how my songs start, and why they're not often catchy is because I just worry about the story. Where the horse started really was I was in central Nevada with an old friend of mine, and we were driving around where I used to go camping a lot. Up until probably pushing 30, I used to camp in this area, central Nevada, and I grew up camping there. And we were maybe 30 miles from the nearest paved road, and we come down this to this big playa. And when I say big, it's like the little sister of where they do the land speed record. It's like literally goes on for, you know, miles and miles and miles where there's nothing out there. It's just like a big salt flat and very little even sagebrush. And there was nothing out there except what looked like this a statue of a black horse. And so we drive up to it. We get out and we realize it's a wild Mustang, and it's an old man, and it's got like a sway back, and it's got scars all over its body, like old people get. Mm-hmm. And as we got closer, I could see that it was completely blind, and it just stopped me in my tracks. That I guess, like, to live your whole life and make it through all those scars to end up in the loneliest place a horse could be, which is blind, so it can't run or see what scares it, and to be alone as a horse is a horrible thing, and that's a big burden to put on one guy to not have his friends about. And it just stopped me in my tracks. And I was, you know, not doing well in my personal life, and I was boozing too much, and it just killed me, that image of it. And it hit home in a way, like a real personal way. So we camped by it that night, and then we drove back into town the next day and called the Bureau of Land Management, and they had a guy that came out for the horse. And then we kept driving on and kept camping, and we came to this old mining claim, and there was an old assayer's office like there is in the horse. And I told my buddy, I just said, you know, I think you should just drop me off here. I don't want to see things like that horse anymore, and I don't want to be around humanity anymore, and I don't want to be me anymore, and I don't want to drink the way I was drinking, and I just didn't want to be me, I guess. And he just started laughing at me, because he knows me, you know, and he's like, Jesus, you're so dramatic. He goes, if you're out there for a week, he goes, you'd be whining that you couldn't plug in your record player, and then you would try to get your wife back, and then you try to get everything back just so you could be where you are right now. So why not quit whining and just be sad about the horse? And And that's why he's my old pal. And he got me home and I was fine and everything and no big deal. And then I started thinking about that horse and music and the idea of drowning and the idea of isolation and the idea of running out of ways to figure out how to be yourself. And to be honest, I just wanted to save the horse. I just wanted to if there was a real horse, I wanted to save it in my own way.
Oh, that's so beautiful. I was thinking about, there's something about a horse. There's something inherently, I mean, noble, yes, beautiful, of course, solitary, yeah. But there's also this vulnerability that I always think about with horses. I'm not sure where that comes from. I'm sure it's just in literature and art and music. But I was thinking about how, wow, think about the fact of a blind horse standing out there in the frigid weather, in the snow, and it's not like a cat you can bring in or a dog you can bring in and take care of. Al couldn't shepherd the horse into any place for cover, and it sure didn't seem like the horse was about to move at that point. But there was something about that feeling of being trapped, of being hopeless in trying to help the horse and whatever the horse represents.
He doesn't know anything about horses. He literally, you know, tries to feed it spaghetti. I mean, so I think there was that aspect of it. But I think what it did is it woke Al up. And I always think of that, you know, if you're drowning, the best way to not drown anymore is to help somebody else who's drowning. And I think seeing the horse makes Al kind of break out of like the quagmire he's in and all the bad avenues he goes down in his mind. That has to stop, and he has to be present, and he has to try to figure out in his own really misguided way how to help the horse. He has absolutely no idea, but he does desperately try to figure out how to help it. And I think in that regard, it saves his life.
Yeah, I really love this. I guess I can call it like the structure of the novel, like this organizing principle that emerges where Al is where he is. He sees the horse and then he's in his routines. He has his Campbell soup. This novel does so much for Campbell soup, let me tell you. But
yeah. The worst kind too, condensed, man. I grew up on that. That's why I put it in there, because that would be like, yeah, that's definitely not how I want to spend my time eating condensed Campbell's soup.
Well, yeah, I thought about that. But this is not, you know, sort of a non-perishable thing that he can, you know, and he's just not somebody in these moments who's going to be very excited about what he's going to eat. He's just sort of surviving. It's just fuel for him. But he moves to recall these chapters in his life. And so we go to his childhood, and we go to his past, and we go to this life of touring with him and this casino circuit that I really knew nothing about before reading this book, or hadn't really considered very much. And then we get to go back into the shack with him as this man in his 60s who's in a bad way, and he looks out the window and the horse is still there. And then there's something else that jogs his memory to something else that we get to go back to. I just thought it was a kind of a genius structure. Not that it's an artifice or it's imposed in any way. We just sort of fall into it. But I just had to mention that. And we're just in it for the ride. And we like listening to the best storyteller that you know. And then you're sort of back in the present moment. And there's plenty of drama to keep us nailed down there, too. But then back we go again. But I wonder if you can talk a little bit about this Reno casino circuit and describe that environment, that where this is for Al, you know, the sort of good things happen to him, but also some of the bad things are taking hold.
First off, I guess about the structure, I was interested in the way your mind kind of pulls at you when you've spent too much time by yourself, how you can get stuck and you can go down one path that leads to another path, and you can't kind of get stuck in a quagmire. I think the structure was really difficult for me in that regard, because I wanted to get it right, the way your mind, you know, like he might be working on a song and then that jogs the memory of his past, or he just keeps following a loop of maybe his ex-wife and he can't get out of it. Or when he starts drinking, his memories change, like you do if, say, if you're drunk or hungover or sick or scared, your memories are all different. So I was trying to get that mixture right of all that stuff, but still have some fun too. And for me, the casino circuit was fun because I grew up at the tail end of that, because I grew up in Reno. And I grew up at the tail end of casino bands. You know, I always romanticized them because a lot of those guys hung out with showgirls. You know, the guys I played with in high school, their dads, two of their dads were the last of like played it on casino floor shows and casino bands. And they always had like these 6'2", really beautiful showgirls as girlfriends, and they slept till noon every day, and they never did anything, it seemed like, except play guitar at night. And I was like, Jesus, man, that's what I want. And but I was never good enough for any of that stuff. And so even though the gigs were horrible, and those guys would take you aside and they'd say, "Will, write your own tunes, never do this because it's really boring," and they yell at you if you're too loud, and they yell at you if you're not playing songs that aren't well known enough. But for me, you know, Reno was so exciting musically in that era for him, like in the 60s and 70s, especially because, you know, Reno was built by guys that owned casinos that had a lot of money, and two of them, like Bill Hara being one of them, he loved music, and he would pay it an exorbitant amount of money to get musicians to play in Reno. And he had you know, an orchestra, like a full-time orchestra, as a part of the house band. And there was, you know, casinos were open 24/7, and people liked to see live music back then. So a lot of guys made a living there. So I was just interested in romantic side of it, and you know, obviously the downside of it. And I've always been really interested in people that want to be famous, especially at low levels. Like when you're in a small time band and you're around somebody that wants to be famous, it's really interesting. And the lower level you are, the cruder their ideas of fame and how to get there are. And I was just interested in all that when I was writing the book. And that was the part that was really fun and easy. That and writing the song titles were like the easy parts of the book.
Oh, I'm so glad you brought this up, both of those things, because I feel like in this world of the casino circuit, Al is he's not someone who can't love. He's someone who can love, and he's someone who can work very hard, and he's someone who's really dedicated to words and writing and music, and he's after the art, as you said before. And even though, you know, there are these trappings of, you know, a certain brand of success that are appealing to him, of course, it just seems like a lot of the time he's driven by a lot of other things, but he gets caught in these traps all the time because he's surrounded by people who maybe are taking advantage of his talent, or they're taking advantage of his good nature and his innocence. You know, he's a little bit naive sometimes. And he's also somebody, I'll just say it, who has flaws. He's also somebody who's beautifully flawed. Because if he weren't, you know, we couldn't read this book. We couldn't have this book. So that he's so complex. He's such a complicated, simple guy. You know, this is what I love about humans, and this is what I love about reading, is characters who are so simple on the surface, and they are really like the most supremely complicated people. And there's a beauty in that. And that touches almost every other aspect of their lives. And then the other thing I want to talk to you about are these song titles. So there's like over 200 something song titles in this book, right?
Yeah, I think there's 232.
I love
I
the
think
song
so.
titles. And they.
Oh, that was so much fun, you know, because I wanted the reader to make up what they think he sounded like. And you can tell a lot about where his head's at and what he's interested in by the song titles. So early on, it might be he's trying to impress or write kind of country hits. And then as he gets older, he starts writing what he wants to write, maybe. Or if he's in love, or if his life's falling apart, you kind of see all these different eras in his life through song titles. And yeah, that was just pure fun. I mean, I always think of Al as like, he's just, I think I said this earlier, I feel like he's always just kind of on his heels. Yeah. And probably just the way he was raised, I think he always kind of had the wind knocked out of him. And he wasn't really loved in a way that kept him up on both feet and made him be able to catch his breath. So I think more than anything, he uses music as a way to escape and a crutch. And so the rest of it doesn't really matter to him. I think the idea of fame and all that stuff, he's like, he lives pretty good. And for a working musician who doesn't have the guts to leave Reno, I mean, I think that needs to be said too, is like, he never really had it in him to move anywhere or be anything other than trying to get by as he is in the town he lives. I think he was more interested in almost an addict of disappearing into the song he was working on.
Yeah, I love those moments when he's in the shack where he puts the rings on, and there's oh my God, that's such a great detail.
I used to do that, you know, like, yeah, because you want to, you want to feel like you're cool, or you want to feel like you're somebody. And for Al, I think he wants to feel like he's like a suave guy when he's working on a song. And I think a lot of that is just like when, you know, when he's 18, 19, 20, he falls in love with an older woman who kind of really, you know, morphs him into the way he is as an adult, at least like the way he dresses.
Yeah.
And his ideas on women are really because of her and his mother, of course.
Yeah. And that's a very complicated thing. So is falling in love with someone like Maxine. And so all of that. And as you say, it's like there's really not a space for him to just catch his breath. But the Telecaster is the thing that sort of resurfaces. I don't know, would it be safe to say that it grounds him? Is that what's happening when he puts the rings on? Is there some semblance of a kind of a grounding that he's after?
Yeah, and the crafts, he's a craftsman. And
he's
so,
a craftsman. Yeah.
And so I think he, instead of dealing with his life or his mother, I don't think really, I mean, like she says in the book, I think she says, I love you because you're my son and a mother loves her children, but I don't like you.
I know.
And I think, and then his first love would be Mona, who's like a 40-year-old, you know, narcissistic, alcoholic, really wants to be a famous singer. And so if you're a damaged person, you're a lot of the time attracted to people that are damaged like you. And so I think he's been attracted to and been around damaged people his whole life. And so I think when he meets Maxine, who's probably the closest version to himself, like she's kind of got it together, mm-hmm. and she's a good person, but she's very dark. She's really struggles with depression. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the closest thing he found to comfort and love. But you know, it's hard when two damaged people fall in love, and unless they're trying to work things out and work on themselves, it oftentimes ends up flipped over in a ditch, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk a little bit about this idea that this novel is not just bleak. I think it's very important to say that out loud as we're talking. It's like, that's not all there is to it. Do you agree with that?
I mean, I am a dark-minded guy for sure, but no, I think Al, I don't think his life is bleak at all. I mean, I think he, like a lot of people do when they get in their 50s, their body starts failing them. Their relationship, if they are drinkers, their relationship to booze changes. But also, if you've had great success or not, bitterness kind of can rear its head. A lot of marriages fall apart in the 50s. Mm-hmm. I think it can be a tough time for people. Yeah. And so for Al, it's just like he decides to isolate when he shouldn't isolate. But I think it's more about survival and about the love of art and compassion. You know, like Al, I feel is a very compassionate guy. And when he has to get out of his own head and kind of save himself so he can save this horse, it shows you that you have to care about your fellow person. And you see that with Lonnie later on in the book, you know, where Lonnie comes back and mm-hmm. tries to help out. I don't feel it's hopeless. I always feel like sometimes my books are the people might not dress as nice, or where they live is a little cruder, but they're just people. And so I don't think it's dark. It's just, there's more realism in it. I think, and sometimes I think people think working class stories are bleak just by their very definition. And I've just never felt that. But that being said, you know, Al is a guy that's struggled with anxiety and his own, you know, version of depression. And he's been surrounded by pretty rough people most of his life. So in that regard, it is tough. But Jesus, most of us have had a tough run here and there.
Well, I do like that your books kind of democratize contemporary literature for us. I mean, that's true. And I want to ask you, you're so prolific. So you write songs, you're with the DeLines, you're a novelist, you've written 7 books, and 4 of these have been movies. Like, when do you sleep?
You know, I've been doing this a long time, so I'm just kind of like slow and steady, you know? I'm just slow and steady, and I don't have kids. You know, I don't have kids, and I don't have to have a straight job, thank God. So I just really like it. I like working on stories. I feel really lucky. You know, there's a day, like the UPS guy just came up my road, and every time I see a UPS truck or see a guy, I was a house painter for years. Every time I see a guy in painting whites, I say to myself, I just got to work harder. I got to work harder because I don't want to be a UPS driver because I'm too lazy, and I don't want to be a house painter because I hated being a house painter. So I think it's half of it is I'm just scared that I'm going to have to go back to working a straight job. Another part is I just feel so grateful that I, like, while everybody in the world's working really hard jobs, I get to tinker on a story. So I feel really lucky that I get to do it, and I love doing it. So I'm not really that prolific. I'm just always kind of working. And the one thing I think I taught myself when I was really young was if you always have one going, then you quit after the next one. So I'd always tell my band, because I was in a band called Richmond Fontaine, and for our first 7 years, no one liked us at all. And I'd always tell the guys, I go, well, let's make one more record, and if they don't like that record, we'll quit. And everybody goes, okay. And then by the time that record came out, I'd already have half a new record. And I'd say, well, let's just, these new songs you guys like, so let's just do this next record. And I did that for 23 years with that band, and I'm doing it 10 years with the DeLines. And I do that with writing. I'm always like, well, maybe this one, it didn't go over so good, but the next one, it's got to be the next one. And so I always have one going so I don't quit. And a lot of that's just because I have no confidence at all. So my confidence has always been very suspect. So I just work hard and always have one on the back burner to build my confidence and to keep me working, you know.
If you've been lucky, then we're the lucky ones because we get to enjoy your music and your novels and also the movies. Is there going to be a horse movie?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I'm talking to a guy, but I'm not sure. Hey, and you know, in my band, the DeLines, Amy Boone lived in Texas. The singer lived in Texas for 35 years, and she was in a band called the Damnations out of Austin, Texas, with her sister, and they were an amazing band. She tells me about Texas all the time.
Oh,
she just
fun.
Moved up here like a couple years ago, a year and a half ago.
Well, talk to me a little bit about the DeLines. Talk to me about Mr. Luck and Miss Doom.
Mr. Luck and Miss Doom, I got that title from an Al Ward song.
Yep.
That he wrote in a bathtub in Winnemucca, Nevada. The DeLines, so there was a band called the Damnations with Deborah Kelly and Amy Boone, based out of Austin. They were a really great band. And my band used to open up for them sometimes. And then I did some songs with her sister, Deborah. And she was going to tour with us. Deborah was, and she got pregnant. She goes, "Look, Will, I can't tour. I'm going to have a baby. What about my sister?" And so Amy came on the road with Richard Fontaine, and we were just doing a radio show in Glasgow, Scotland. And she was in the music room on the piano, and I was in the control booth, and there was just a hot mic, and I could hear her playing a ballad to herself. And she didn't know that I could hear it, but I could hear it. And the way she sang it, I just said to myself, I want to grow old in a band where she sings all the songs, and I want to be in a band where a woman sings every song, because I love women singers the best. And I want to be in a band that sings big ballads and is like country soul. I always had a crush on Bobby Gentry, and I wanted to be in a band like that. So I just went home for maybe a year and wrote her songs. She didn't know she didn't know anything about it. And I wrote her a thesis, basically a letter thesis on why she should join up with me. And then she heard the songs and flew up to Portland, where the band, me and the drummer from Richmond Fontaine, Sean Oldham, put a band together. And she came up, we practiced like three times and cut the record, and people liked it, and we got to be the DeLines, which is heaven for me, because I get to write songs for a woman. No one pays attention to me. I can hide in the back, and I can hear her sing every night, and so I'm just in heaven. And I get to write middle-aged women songs, which it's just it's just like getting out of jail. It's, you know, it's just fun to write those kind of tunes. And she tells me when she likes them and when she doesn't. And Mr. Luck and Miss Doom started because she took me aside after a gig, and she said, "Look, man, you got to write me a love song where no one dies and nothing goes wrong, because I'm a normal girl. I want a little romance, you know, once in a while. Why does everybody always have to die in your love songs?" And I'm like, "You're right, you're right." And so I went home and I wrote her. Oh man, I wrote her maybe five or six happily ever after songs, and but the only good one was Mr. Luck and Miss Doom, about a depressive house cleaner and a bumbling criminal who, you know, only did one crime, and he got caught, and he did 4 years in prison for it. And somehow together they live happily ever after. She makes all the rules and holds their money and tells them what to do. And he keeps her from getting too depressed. He keeps her sane enough to get by in this world. And she liked that one. And then I was off the hook, and I started writing love songs where people died and, you know, all that. I went back to my old tricks after that.
Miss Doom was half living in her car, cleaning houses in St. Augustine, Florida. Mr. Luck had just gotten on the bus. He'd done 4 years. First crime, first bust, that's how his name stuck.
I want to see that movie.
Yeah, me too. I like that gal. Like, I mean, there's nothing worse than, there's an image of it in St. Augustine, Florida, where she's cleaning a mansion, and there's a huge cross in St. Augustine, and she goes outside, and she's getting yelled at by her boss, and outside of like a McMansion. And I just, there's nothing worse than being in a bad job, yeah, and getting yelled at, you know, in a rough way, in a really unprofessional way, and being so stuck you can't quit. There's something so heartbreaking about that. And so I put that image in, but again, she gets out because she falls madly in love with Mr. Luck, as they call him, and she gets away from all that.
Well, I've listened to these songs, and they are beautiful. So to be able to listen to the music and then sit with the horse for a while and read it, I'm telling you, I've had so much fun with it. Willie Blauton, thank you so much for talking to me today. I really appreciate it. I'm so honored. I feel so thrilled to be able to talk to you.
I've had a wonderful time. You're very nice. Thank you for reading the horse and listening to the lines. It means a lot.
First it was a man with missing fingers, and he was in a mood. tried to break down a door, but the manager gave him the boot. Across the street was a line, I could see it from the pool. 8:50 a.m., liquor store, the man was heading there too. Counting the minutes with his seven fingers shaking. Maureen's gone missing. Yeah, it's true.
That was Maureen's Gone Missing from the album Mr. Luck and Miss Doom by the DeLines. Earlier, you heard a little bit from The Haunting Thoughts and the title track from Mr. Luck and Ms. Doom. Willie Loughton is the author of The Horse. It's published by Harper, an imprint of HarperCollins. Mr. Luck and Ms. Doom is the latest album by the DeLines. It's out now via El Cortes Records. It's a gorgeous playlist for this unforgettable story about addiction, loneliness, and second chances. You can learn more about Willie Loughton, his novels, his movies, and music at his website, willievloughton.com. This has been Book Public from Texas Public Radio. Thanks for listening. You can write to us at bookpublic@tpr.org. Jacob Rosati composed our theme music. Dan Katz is Texas Public Radio's news director. I'm Yvette Benavides.